This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
On FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
And this is Jennifer Renee.
Brian Levinka.
And this is Jack Belitsky.
And we're all here. We're short a few.
Well, Glenn is, we thought he was up fixing the shuttle or something like that. But no, actually, he's visiting his mother in...
Ottawa, Canada, yeah.
Yes, up in Canada. I saw a great movie this past weekend.
What was that?
I believe it's called Every Step You Take. It's
Every Little Step.
Every Little Step.
It's a chronological reenactment or kind of the process to create a chorus line. And kind of a documentary behind the scenes.
Yes, it's fabulous.
I haven't seen it, but I want to see it.
Where did you see it?
It's at the River Oaks.
Oh, okay.
And it's a documentary. It showed some of the original footage. How they did it was, is they basically had a number of people sit around taping it back when it was first put together. And watching the process of how they auditioned people, there was over three. This is Revival. The Revival.
Right. Oh, okay.
Which has since come and gone on Broadway.
Yes. And, there was over 3,000 people that auditioned for the second time. And it was just incredible. And I don't want to give it away, but when it ended, nobody left their seats until the credits were finished, and then there was clapping.
Oh, that's great.
So if you're into musicals...
If you're into musicals...
Me. Yes.
It is a fabulous movie.
And if you have that special gay gene...
I do.
On tonight's show...
We have the... raspy voice Sally Huff from Montrose Counseling.
Sexy voice.
sexy, raspy voice from the Montrose Counseling Center. She's going to be talking about coming out, and for those that are coming out for support, and also a new program for those that are deaf and GOBT, which I don't know how they're going to hear the program, but we're going to get the Morse code or something to them. I don't know. And then, of course, we have Queer Music Heritage coming on later in the show.
With J.D. Doyle, yes. As always. Be nice to have him in the studio one of these days again.
Yes, J.D. Long-lost J.D. out in the woodlands.
Well, he's doing his part to create a progressive woodlands.
And we appreciate that, because a gayer woodlands is a better woodlands.
Is there anything else going on this week in the city?
I don't know. I just got back from New York, where I was watching some Broadway plays. So I'm going to have to kind of...
You're in New York? Tell us about New York.
Well, I went up there with my partner, and we watched West Side Story, which is the revival of that, and it was fantastic. And then, okay, I'm going to tell you now, there's a new musical called Far From Normal, or Next to Normal, I'm sorry. I just saw it yesterday. It's a musical about a bipolar mom and her family and all their interactions and how she kind of goes off into the crazy land with medication and everything. Tremendous. It's an awesome musical. So I highly recommend that if you're in New York at any time.
Well, did you see any movies this weekend? Oh, you were up in New York.
I was in New York. I didn't get to see any movies, but I do want to see... let's see, what was the last movie? What's the movie? Last movie that you saw?
I saw Star Trek.
Yes, that was wonderful.
The new one. Being a Trekker from way back to the 60s, and we would not... I was in college, and we would hold off going out on dates just to see Star Trek. I mean, it was the college phenomena.
And it's updated for the new generation.
For the new generation.
With a couple of hotties as Captain Kirk and Mr.
Now, as far as my rating on it, and this is the Jennifer rating scale, it got 4 stars out of 4.
It got 4 enthusiastic thumbs up.
4 stars out of 4.
On the Brian scale, it was 4 thumbs up.
Oh, thumbs up. Okay.
Enthusiastic,
well,
yes.
Well, I got the stars.
Yes.
But it was very good. It played homage to the Star Trek world that we've all known from the 60s on. But it created a new scenario where it could go forward with new stories, with the new cast. And it was very good. I really appreciated it.
I appreciate it, too. And there was more skin in this one, I thought.
Oh, we don't give it away. If you haven't seen it, go see it.
Go see it. I saw it on IMAX, and it was like, whoa.
I did, too. I went in there. It took me 3 days to get into IMAX. They kept selling out.
Yeah.
Too many Trekkers around. I think we're still alive. See, we haven't gotten quite old.
You know, I want to go see the Terminator movie, Salvation.
I heard it was good.
I was going to go see
it. I heard
that,
it was good. I haven't seen it, but someone else has, and they gave me a review of it and said it was very good.
I'm a big sci-fi fan, so I have to drag David along, and he's not a big sci-fi fan. Are you, David? No.
He's not answering, is he?
No, I hear him in my head. No. No, I try to convince him to go to sci-fi, and he's like, no, he'd rather not. So, so every once in a while, I get him to come.
But there's a lot of good movies out there.
Oh, yeah.
And I enjoyed it. And let's see. We got a little music coming, don't we?
I believe so.
Let's hear it.
I played with my Barbie when I was a kid. It sure was the most fun thing that I ever did. But when Daddy found out, boy, he flipped his lid. I should have been born a girl. My Daddy, he said, are you my daughter or son? And I said, oh, Daddy, do I have to pick one? Then I'll be your daughter. It's so much more fun. I should have been born a girl. You have to understand I have a feminine side, and feeling soft and pretty isn't something to hide. I like wearing makeup. It covers my flaws. I go get a facial to close up my pores. I dress as a woman. I do it because I should have been born a girl. Although I'm a fella, I carry a purse. I don't get my period, but something much worse. Too much testosterone is really the curse. I should have been born a girl. So who am I? I often sit and wonder. Did nature make a terrible blunder? I just got a letter. I read it and wow, I've just been accepted as a member of NOW. Although I'm a fella, I joined anyhow. I should have been born a girl. Well, I think I have the answer, so that when I get home, I'll look through all the want ads for an X chromosome. I'd love to be female, think I'll give it a whirl. I should have been born a girl.
And you were listening to Jennifer's theme song.
Everybody's laughing at me. I was sitting here in the studio singing it.
Singing along. Like,
yes. The only thing I didn't do to get up is dance.
Well, if we'd have gone any longer, you would have done
that.
It
was singing. Singing would have been enough. Thank God the microphone wasn't on.
Jennifer, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
When did you come out?
When did I come out?
Yes.
1994 did I come out of the closet.
1994.
But I had been... dressing in the closet and all since I was 9 years old.
And did you have any support or anybody to go to, or is it kind of just on your own?
Up until 94, it was all on my own.
Well,
I was just a frightened little girl in a closet.
Well, flash forward to today, 2009, and we have a new group at
yes.
the wonderful Montrose Counseling Center. And
Montrose Counseling Center, yes.
In the studio today is Sally, and I don't know what kind of voice she's going to have. She's been hoarse.
She has a sexy voice.
Sally, hello.
Hello. I'm going to do my very best.
Okay.
I apologize to people.
We have a lot of talking to do.
Your best is good enough. Don't ever worry about that.
Thank you.
We're just happy to have you here.
It sounds worse than it really is. It doesn't hurt at all.
Okay. It sounds pretty rough, but we'll go on with it. We'll keep on going.
Well, what's new?
Wow, we've got a lot of stuff going on, and as Brian was talking about, we have a new coming out support group that's starting up. And we do this a couple times a year, and the next one is going to be starting on June 18th. And it's for anybody that identifies as gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender, or if they're still questioning any of those things. And so it's a support group that we do, like I said, a couple times a year. And it's open to anybody. You don't have to be a client of the counseling center to attend the group. And they have a whole group of topics that they'll cover to help people. Because even though, you know, you said that you came out in 1994, Brian, when did you come out?
I came out, I've always been gay, but I came out in 1992.
Well, and we always have to make decisions on a daily basis how far we're going to come out. I mean, I'm guessing that Jennifer doesn't every day. She goes shopping, talk to this clerk at the, you know, grocery store. By the way, did you know that I'm transgender? No. I'm
guessing, and I don't have a scarlet T on my forehead.
Right,
either.
Exactly. So you make a choice sometimes when you choose to come out, whether that's to your family, whether that's to, you know, your employer. Sometimes it's whether or not you're going to become active in the community.
Mm-hmm.
And so coming out is an ongoing process for everyone. What if somebody, you go to work tomorrow morning and they say, hey, how did you spend your Memorial Day weekend? Are you going to say, hey, I just went to New York and watched all the Broadway shows.
We had a gay old weekend in New York City watching Broadway.
You know, so you're going to make a choice.
I always like to say, I did stuff with friends.
Well, exactly. So and depending upon who you're talking to, I mean,
yeah.
If you're on Facebook, you might say one thing. But if you're talking to your potential employer,
exactly.
You might choose something else.
Yeah.
So it's an ongoing process for a lot of people. And there are a lot of things that we will discuss. I brought a list, so I hope you'll indulge me.
So
do you want us to read that? Or
would you like some help?
We're trying to save your voice.
Question I have is that, okay, so the support group is for those people coming out or those that may be partially out or even out.
Sure.
Just to get support and talk about ways of handling different situations. So just because you have come out doesn't mean that this isn't for you too.
Exactly. Because let's say that you are out with your friends and all of your friends know that you identify as gay or lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. That doesn't mean that you're not going to face difficulty when you come out to your family. And let's face it, almost everybody that I talk to will say, well, yeah, I came out to my family, but we don't tell grandma.
Yeah, it'll just kill her.
You know, there's somebody in the family that we don't come out to. And so sometimes, you know, we very well may be quite out, but we might be dealing some of those with those extended family issues or, like I said, with an employer or, you know, something like that.
And
co-workers.
And you have to decide who you're going to come out to. I know that in my own case, I never think about it anymore. I'm just out there. And the fact is, though, that I may meet someone and maybe they don't know. And you have to decide whether it's important to just say something to them and let them know that ahead of time or maybe not. You know, it's just a matter of whether it makes any difference. I know that when I'm working and on clients, my new clients are all recommendations from someone else, another success, you know, client that I've worked with. And so I just assume they either know or don't care.
In my case, I was working on my last job. One of my coworkers found me in Outsmart and said that she knew a friend of mine. I'm like, oh, gosh, here we go. So, you know, although I'm very open and out in my life and in my community activities, I wasn't out at work because, I work in oil and gas, and it's kind of still Bubba.
Bubba country.
Bubba redneck country. So, you know, it kind of, and when she approached me, of course, I can't deny it. So I took her on the side, and I told her, yes, you know, I am gay. And I do a lot of stuff in the community, you know, and at that point I can't really deny it, you know. And
well,
I think it's...
And that's the thing, too, that somebody that's going to be picking up Health Smart magazine and flipping through the pages is probably going to be a little bit more accepting. They're probably not going through saying, oh, who's my next target? Who do I know?
Yeah, exactly. If she's looking at Elsmore, she's
oh, yeah. That's like I remember in those early days when I'd slip into one of the gay bars or something like that to catch the drag show on a Saturday night, I'd be worried that someone would see me. Never but dawning on me, if they're there, it doesn't matter.
They're kind of, okay with it. And
well, I am going to hand this to you and ask you to read some of the topics that they're going to cover.
I would like to read it.
Oh, you go right ahead.
Okay, some of the topics included are coming out, homophobia and self-loathing, spirituality for GLBT persons, gay history / gay pride, coming out to others, coming out to family, coming out in the workplace, healing the hurt, prejudice and discrimination, coming out a lifelong process, and finally, healthy relationships.
Exactly.
So those are some of the topics that this this group will cover.
Right, and it's going to, like I said, begin on June 18th. And let me tell you, you have this.
Yes.
The paper.
We're handing the paper back and forth.
It's going to be meeting for 8 consecutive weeks on Thursday evenings at Montrose Counseling Center from 6 to 7:30.
Now, where, if people have no idea where that is, what's the address?
Well, the address is 401 Brannard Street. And that's not always easy to find because it's nestled
it's
in the neighborhood.
Really hard to find.
If you know where the High School for the Performing and Visual Arts is, mm-hmm. it's nestled in that neighborhood. But you can go to our website, www.montrosecounselingcenter.org. And we have, conveniently, in the upper right-hand corner, you can click on Map. And it'll show you a map of how to get to Montrose Counseling Center.
I see. And if you know the old Fitness Exchange building, that's where it is now.
Exactly.
If some of you in the community know that.
It's today I was talking to a girlfriend, and in our conversation she was talking about therapy and support. And in the part of the conversation she said that she had found the best support and all from the Montrose Counseling Center.
Oh, I'm
which
so
was
thrilled to hear
and
that.
It was just all of a sudden out of nowhere with no conversation that came up in the everybody listening to this knows that the Montrose Counseling Center, if you have any situation, you need to go there first.
Well, right.
Talk
I mean,
somebody.
We're talking about the coming out support group, but we can do any type of counseling. We have actually four counseling programs. One is your basic life counseling program. One is for chemical dependency outpatient treatment. One is for HIV counseling. And the other is for the anti-violence program. So
that's anti-violence.
I know.
No, anti-violence program.
Yes.
Well done. So not just for coming out, but any kind of issue, whether it's anxiety or depression, whether it's relationship issues, whether it's religious abuse, you know, eating disorders, any of those kinds of things, somebody can come in and talk to a therapist. And it's going to be culturally affirming. It's going to be affordable, and you're going to get quality services.
Some have called it Houston's best-kept secret.
I like to call it that, too. Thank you.
A lot of people don't know about it, but it does a lot of things under one roof.
And it helps a lot of people. That's the important part.
And I like the SPRI program, too. I think that's innovative.
For the seniors, it's wonderful.
Yes.
In fact, we'll talk about that in just a second. Well, but I have something else that I want to talk about.
Well, let's hear what you want to talk about.
I'm kind of curious about how this will work.
Here's the thing. We're a big community, right?
Right.
So we're all connected to one another.
Right. Facebook.
Good example. MySpace. Just your friends and family. There's an organization here called the Astro Rainbow Alliance for the Deaf.
Mm-hmm.
I realize, you know, we've been kind of, you know, joking who's going to be listening to the radio, but somebody's going to be out there listening.
Right. They can watch the streaming video.
Yes, I hope hundreds of thousands of listeners are out there,
right.
And they can tell their deaf friends.
Tell your deaf friends. We are going to be starting a deaf and GLBT support group.
Okay.
That's open to anybody, again, who identifies as gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender. We already provide services for people with hearing issues. We have a case manager who has an LBSW. Her name is Leanne Randolph. She is hearing, but she knows American Sign Language, mm-hmm. and she has a video phone. And so she's able to provide services to her clients
already
who have hearing issues. So she's going to be starting this deaf support group. I was just talking to somebody the other day, and they said, well, what kind of things would somebody need a deaf support group versus any other kind of support group? And I thought, you know, this is kind of the same thing with chemical dependency. Let's say you're deaf and you belong to a support group already. Well, if somebody in your group, or say the facilitator of the group, is not affirming to sexual orientation or gender identity issues, you might censor yourself around issues about relationships or about who you really are. Mm-hmm. Same thing with chemical dependency.
I see.
If you're in a support group, that's great. But how are you going to get the help that you need and the healing that you deserve unless you can talk openly and honestly about what it's like being a deaf person?
Deaf and gay.
GLBT.
GLBT, yeah.
Exactly. Can you talk about relationship issues? I mean, it must be pretty hard for somebody out there to find someone and learn sign language to be able to communicate. Well, once you reduce that pool to you're only looking for a gay partner, a lesbian partner, and then reduce that pool even further, somebody who's gay that I'm attracted to, that's willing to learn American Sign Language. You know, so this might be an issue. And do you think that's going to come up in your broad spectrum deaf support group?
Maybe not.
Maybe not.
Depends on what they're wearing on the day.
Well, if they're wearing pink like the two of you seem to coordinate.
It's gay day.
Today's Memorial Gay Pink Day.
So I obviously didn't get the memo.
Yeah.
But
no.
But so it's an opportunity for people to get support that they need and to find other people who are out there like them. Because there is a sense of community, being able to find people who are going through some of the same things that you're going through.
So when does this start, GLBT support group?
Yeah, it starts not this next week, but the following week. And that's also on Thursdays. The first meeting is going to be on June 4th. And it's going to meet for every other week.
Okay.
For 8 weeks.
8 weeks every other week. So
every other week. And those are open meetings. Just like the coming out support group, the deaf and GLBT support group, there is no charge. And you don't have to be a client of Montrose Counseling Center to attend either one. They're just drop-in groups. If you want to make a donation, of course, we're going to take a donation. We really appreciate that. But these are driven by what we found as a need in the community. And so we're going to be providing the service.
Well, an important thing to remember, even for this group, the new group you're starting for the deaf, but there are also people out there that have all sorts of other issues and don't have a resource. And the Montrose Counseling Center is someplace they can go.
Certainly.
To talk about it, to talk to somebody, to access what they do need. So I honor you for that.
And what I've noticed is there's a lot of community meetings going on there now.
The first floor is amazing.
It's like a hub, a beehive of
I know. Community. The Pride Committee has moved in.
Yeah.
PFLAG is there. We have GCAM, the Gulf Coast Archive and Museum of GLBT History, and they have a lot of their archives are filling up the walls. So
I love seeing all that,
right.
All the old stuff.
It's where Hatch meets. We've got a lot of people holding meetings there. The National Leather Association is meeting there. Bunnies has met there. So a lot of different groups. Dignity, the gay Catholic organization, holds mass there on Saturday evenings. I don't know if it's full mass or they have services there on Saturday evenings. So there's a lot of things happening on the first floor. We're extremely excited about that because the more people that come to Montrose Counseling Center, we hope will help reduce the stigma that so many people associate with receiving mental health care. Since we're wrapping up May is Mental Health Awareness Month, so I just want to say real quick.
You got a couple more days, right?
Yeah, right. It is not a sign of weakness to ask for help.
Yes. You don't have to wait till next May either.
Yes.
You
can just be aware for the next couple of days that this is the month.
This is just the month. We talk about it more than other times.
Any other, June 1st, you could go to the Montrose Counseling Center.
Exactly.
For mental things, too.
Yes.
So if we could, though, you had mentioned the SPRI program.
I love the SPRI program.
Yes, I love SPRI.
And SPRI stands for?
Seniors Progressing Through the Rainbow Years.
Preparing. You're so close.
Preparing through the...
The SPRI program is going to be featured in a program that's airing on Houston PBS. I'm getting goosebumps thinking about it.
When is this going to happen?
It's going to be on June 3rd.
So, like, Channel 8 here.
Channel 8 here, Houston PBS. Now, we are crossing our fingers because it's possible that this show may air in other markets in the state of Texas. Let me tell you the name of the show. It's called Montrose, Texas, The Transformation of a Neighborhood. Now, we're excited to be a part of it, Montrose Counseling Center and the SPRI program. But the program is not just about us. I guarantee you watch this show, it will bring back so many memories. We have some archival footage from the Gulf Coast Archive and Museum of GLBT History that shows, I was looking at some footage of Marion Coleman when she was the Houston Pride Parade Grand Marshal in 1983.
Wow.
And you juxtapose that against an interview with Marion Coleman right now. She talks, and these people talk about, I'm talking about Ray Hill, John Kellett, Marion Coleman, Suzanne Anderson, Brandon Wolf, our very own Jimmy Carper. Mm-hmm. Talk about what this neighborhood means to them. We talk to Anise Parker, Sue Lovell. I mean, so many people weigh in on what this neighborhood has meant to them, and especially because it is so strongly identified, not just with the gay community, but with tolerance of all people. The diversity here, whether we're talking about, you know, the tattoo parlors, or the goth community, mm-hmm. or the arts community, the bohemian, you know, all of that stuff kind of comes together in this and makes it such a wonderful, welcoming place.
It's a little oasis in the middle of the loop.
But it's transforming, and that's what one of the things that we're looking at.
Is that a good or a bad thing?
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah.
You know, we're seeing a lot of development here. We're seeing a lot of tear down of a lot of old homes. We're seeing a lot of people restoring old homes.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of that. And so that's what this TV show is going to focus on, is the transformation of the neighborhood. And we do look at what the impact is on the gay community, especially as GLBT people are aging.
Mm-hmm.
Are they able to, I mean, this property, oh, Sharon Montgomery is in the show. She's fantastic. She talks about how the property values are going skyrocketing in this community. Well, if your property values are going up, are you going to be able to pay your taxes anymore?
Exactly.
You know, Suzanne Anderson is in the show with her little dog, Elmo, that accompanies her everywhere. And she talks about how, you know, this community was well known for being the gay community, and the gays came in and, to use her word, they fluffed it up. They fluffed up the community. And now people are moving in and seeing that this area has a lot of value.
Yeah.
And so we talk with Dan Martin, who is a tattoo artist and business owner at Scorpion Studios. And he talks about, you know, well, people are coming in it because they love the neighborhood, but then they want to change things.
Exactly.
And so these are some of the things that are addressed in the show.
I can't wait to see it.
We have, I mean, you'll see a lot of people that you recognize. We have footage from Houston Pride Parades past.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, we've got stuff from the Gulf Coast Archive and Museum. We've got stuff from the Texas Library, the Texas Room.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some archival stuff. And so I want to mention, I don't know how much time we have, but we did, we worked very closely with Sunset Productions,
mm-hmm.
and Jim Bailey to work on this project. Also through Fast Cut Films, Mike Snow and Mark Sussman were the editors and the camera people. Such incredible people to work with. Really understand the vision of what Sunset Productions and Jim Bailey was trying to get across. And the show, I'm telling you, is 28 minutes long. When it's over, you'll wish that it was an hour long. You'll want to see more.
Mm-hmm.
You'll, you know. And so we're really hoping that a lot of people will tune in on Houston PBS.
And that starts on?
It's on June 3rd. It's part of their pledge drive.
Okay.
So I'm also going to tell you that.
They're going to use us to raise money.
We have just gone through our pledge drive and fund drive. So.
And people need to remember to make their payments to KPFT.
Very
when
good.
They pledge.
Absolutely.
So, but it's going to be part of another pledge drive for another station. And but there's also an opportunity for people to purchase the video.
Mm-hmm.
Montrose, Texas, The Transformation of a Neighborhood.
Where would they be able to purchase it? Through,
well,
can't Channel 8? Or
they would have to watch the program to find out the
details. I'm sure there'll be lots of information on how to purchase.
Yeah.
So use your DVR if you aren't available to watch it. Do you have any idea what time it's going to be on?
It's going to be on at 9 p.m.
9 p.m. June 3rd. Wednesday.
I don't know if you all experience this, but what I'm hoping is that sometimes you get when it's pleasure drive time, you get into a loop, and hopefully they'll air it again and again and again.
They do.
So we're very excited. The program is hosted by Ernie Manous.
Ernie Manous, a friend of the show of Queer Voices. He's been on here.
And so we're extremely excited about this program airing.
So, Sally, let's recap what's going on at the Montrose Counseling Center. And I can do most of it if you want.
Well, please do, but I want to give out the website. Because if you can't catch up everything, there's this and more at www.montrosecounselingcenter.org.
And you have a coming out group that's just starting.
June 18th,
and that's going to be for 6 or 8 weeks.
It's going to be for 8 weeks.
8 weeks, and then there's a group for deaf and GLBT. So mm-hmm. if you have any friends that are deaf and are gay, GLBT.
And it'll go from Thursday, June 4th through Thursday, September 3rd.
Right, every other week.
Every other week.
All right, well, that and many other great programs are on at the Montrose Counseling Center. Check it out.
Give the email address one more time.
Well, the web address is www.montrosecounselingcenter.org. And thank you so much for having me on, and also to all the listeners for your patience with my terrible voice.
No problem.
No problem.
This is Queer Voices.
Thank you, Sally.
Seriously, legalizing gay marriage is, in fact, a really simple-to-understand gold mine.
I really didn't know much about Harvey Milk when he was living, but Harvey Milk is my hero, too.
Dass ich so verliere, den Schuss so verziehe, ich wollte spielen, spielen, spielen. It takes more than a key to unlock my
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Activists around the world speak with one voice for Idaho. Republican Chair Steele's unbridled anti-marriage illogic and Swiss folk pop, Scott's personal playback, and English acoustic rock in the audiophile. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Chris Coleman.
And I'm Rick Watts.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending May the 23rd, 2009. Events in more than 50 countries around the world mark the 4th annual Idaho on May the 17th. That's the International Day Against Homophobia and Transphobia. It's held to commemorate the elimination of homosexuality on that day in 1990 from the World Health Organization's list of mental disorders. In a groundbreaking online action, some 359 people from 48 countries across 6 continents participated in a YouTube-posted awareness video called Idaho 2009, One Voice, One Message, Heard Around the World. The backdrops included the Sydney Opera House, the Great Wall of China, the Statue of Liberty, the Golden Gate Bridge, and the Eiffel Tower.
At least 27 cities in France held Idaho discussions, film screenings, and other political and cultural events, including a national conference on transgender issues at the National Parliament. The country's health minister announced that day that France would be the first country on Earth to stop using the World Health Organization's remaining classification of trans people as mentally disordered.
Several cities across the UK also held Idaho events, including the raising of the rainbow flag over police stations in Liverpool and Manchester. A party was held in London to inspire same-gender couples to hold hands in public. A religious service to mark Idaho was held in Belfast's oldest church, and a photo exhibit focusing on homophobia in South Wales was held in Swansea.
The 27-member nation European Union issued a strong statement calling for renewed mobilization against homophobia and transphobia. It called sexual orientation or gender identity-based discrimination a blatant violation of human dignity. Idaho rallies were also held in Montreal and Sydney.
A few brave gay activists in Cameroon endured hostile comments during a national call-in radio program, while similarly courageous LGBT young people in Iran sent an open letter to the Students' Union. Hundreds marched in Ankara and other major cities in Turkey to protest the rising tide of anti-queer violence in that country.
Last year, Costa Rica's President Oscar Arias issued a decree declaring May 17th as the National Day of Fighting Discrimination Against Sexual Minorities. This year, there were government-sponsored presentations in workplaces across the country against intolerance, and a first-ever inter-university festival for sexual diversity was held on several college campuses. Many government buildings also flew the rainbow flag.
Cuban President Raul Castro's openly lesbian daughter, Mariela, led a conga line around two city blocks in downtown Havana to mark the International Day Against Homophobia and Transphobia. The festive event featured several drummers and costumed stilt walkers. Educational panels and other presentations about sexual diversity were also held.
Chanting, "Love is not a crime," Chinese activists held a symbolic die-in to protest the lack of discrimination protections in Hong Kong and the exclusion of same-gender couples from domestic violence laws. A Beijing, Idaho observance focused on a Rainbow in Motion multi-campus bike ride that organizers said was designed to raise general public awareness of LGBT peoples and their concerns.
A pre-Idaho event was held on the afternoon of May 16th in Singapore. Some 2,500 people, all wearing pink, stood in a formation to spell out the word love during an outdoor festival-like event at Speaker's Corner, a government-designated park for free speech and public assembly. This was the first public LGBT event that was not severely restricted or banned outright by the government. Thousands of people of varying orientation, some with children and several with pink ribbon-adorned dogs, also enjoyed various cultural performances as they picnicked on the grass.
The South Korean Gay Men's Rights Group issued an English-language statement that may have best summed up the purpose of Idaho. "We by no means will be satisfied simply with celebrating this day and boosting our own morale. On the contrary, this is the day to declare that the phobia of all sexual minorities and of all transgressions against existing gender roles is a serious ailment requiring treatment."
People in several Russian cities simultaneously released brightly colored balloons into the air on May 17th. The balloons had messages on postcards attached to them, mostly with personal stories urging others who found them to fight homophobia. But another attempt to hold yet another banned Pride event in Moscow on May 16th was violently broken up by riot police. Up to 80 people were arrested, including Russian organizer Nikolai Alexeyev, British human rights activist Peter Tatchell, Chicago activist Andy Thayer, and at least three women from Finland, a lesbian couple and their adult daughter. This year's effort to demonstrate pride came just hours before the finals of the Eurovision Song Contest, held in Moscow this year because Russia won the contest last year. The competition has a huge gay following across the continent. While activists had urged performers to express their solidarity with the pride action, none did. Police arrested Alexeyev, Tatchell, Thayer, and a few others in the middle of interviews with reporters, in some cases shoving cameramen out of the way to get at them. Protesters were dragged into waiting buses. Most were released within 24 hours, and no serious injuries were reported.
But about 600 people took part in a first-ever peaceful Pride March on the same day in the Latvian capital of Riga. The city council had first granted a permit for the event, then withdrew it. An appeals court allowed the march to proceed just a day before it was scheduled. People from 20 different countries participated, some brought to Riga by human rights group Amnesty International to demonstrate global solidarity for the event. Previous LGBT marches in the city have been disrupted by extreme right-wing nationalist groups. In a significant turnaround, Latvian state police said they've launched an administrative investigation into an unauthorized countermarch that had been organized by religious groups and nationalists. An estimated 20,000 people also partied at Belgium's 14th annual Pride Parade in Brussels.
In U.S. news, the New Hampshire State House unexpectedly rejected amendments this week to the marriage equality bill it had previously passed. Democratic Governor John Lynch has demanded stronger language to protect religious institutions from discrimination lawsuits or from being forced to perform same-gender weddings or to provide benefits to the partners of lesbian and gay workers. While the amendments were defeated by two votes, House lawmakers did reject efforts to kill the marriage bill entirely and asked the Senate, which had already approved the amendments, to negotiate compromise language. Equality activists remain confident that a bill Lynch can accept will land on his desk and be signed into law.
Legislation to create domestic partnerships for Nevada's same-gender couples, providing many of the rights of marriage, passed the state assembly by a vote of 26-14 this week. It now returns to the Senate, which had passed the measure by a vote of 12-9 to accept amendments the House had added. Republican Governor Jim Gibbons, however, has vowed to veto the bill in any form.
But Democratic Colorado Governor Bill Ritter signed legislation this week to provide health insurance and a few other benefits to the domestic partners of Colorado state workers. The legislation covers both same-gender and unmarried heterosexual couples who must have been in a committed relationship for at least a year. It also includes the right to receive state employee pension benefits, the right to make medical decisions for an incapacitated partner, and the right to inherit if a partner dies without a will.
And finally, two stories this week seem to underscore the phrase, "and the children will lead them." But one youngster's efforts met with resistance. A Ramona, California sixth grader was forbidden to give a presentation about Harvey Milk in her class. Natalie Jones said she was inspired to learn more about the gay rights pioneer after watching the Oscar-winning film about him. But she was called into the principal's office the day before her planned presentation at Mount Woodson Elementary School. Natalie was told she could not talk about Milk because it violated the school district's strict policy on family life and sex education. Bonnie Jones, Natalie's mother, called the ordeal unbelievable in a press release issued by the American Civil Liberties Union. They filed a complaint against the school, demanding an apology, the chance for Natalie to give her presentation, and a clarification of the school district's so-called sex education policy.
But a third grader in Denver, Colorado, successfully organized a rally in support of marriage equality this week in the state capitol. 9-year-old Ethan McNamee lined up speakers and secured the required permits to stage the event. His teacher, Kyle Kimmel, at Montclair Elementary School, assisted organizationally, and a few of his classmates helped him make signs. Parents were notified about Ethan's project, and only students who wanted to get involved participated. Ethan told reporters that he got the idea to organize the rally after hearing kids make anti-gay remarks on his school's playground and learning that a same-gender couple in his neighborhood couldn't get married. More than 200 people turned up to show their support on the steps of Colorado's state capitol. Ethan told the crowd, "I believe I am doing the right thing. I hope this rally will make an impact and let our voices be heard."
That's News Wrap for the week ending May 23rd, 2009. The California Supreme Court was expected to announce its Proposition 8 marriage equality ruling on Tuesday, May 26th. We'll have comprehensive coverage of that ruling and reaction to it next week.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Chris Coleman.
And I'm Rick Watts.
We'll honor a gay icon on his birthday and answer the musical question, do you wire daisies when the honeymoon is over if the couple is just coming up for air? That's later in the program. Marriage equality proponents usually base their arguments on fairness and don't often trumpet the well-documented economic benefit. But controversial Republican National Committee Chairman Michael Steele claimed this week that opening civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples would unfairly saddle small businesses with increased spousal health care costs. However, based on accepted population percentages, it would appear that there are far more heterosexual workers posing such a horrific threat to small business. News commentator Keith Olbermann further dissected Steele's questionable logic on his MSNBC Countdown program.
Chairman Michael Steele of the Republican National Committee says his party can retool its message and sell it to a broader base by recasting its culture war issues as lessons in pocketbook economy. For instance, he now says, if it paints gay marriage as an attack on small business because they have to pay more health care, because all those gay partners would suddenly be gay husbands and gay wives and legally designated gay beneficiaries. Our number one story, what the? Now, all of a sudden, Steele warns, I've got someone who wasn't a spouse before that I had no responsibility for, who is now getting claimed as a spouse that I now have financial responsibility for. So how do I pay for that? Who pays for that? You just cost me money. You want to sell opposition to gay marriage on economic grounds as a kind of drag on small business? Mr. Steele, in this country, weddings are a $70 billion a year industry. B, billion, as in Bridezilla. $70 billion. Most of it spread among local florists, local jewelers, local caterers, local photographers, local hotels, local restaurants, local bridal stores. Admittedly, the number of wedding gowns ordered when two men get married is usually zero. But think of the all-women weddings with two gowns and two sets of bridesmaids. Seriously, legalizing gay marriage is, in fact, a really simple-to-understand gold mine, especially in terms of jump-starting a lousy economy like, say, the one you Republicans gave us, the one that is doing a lot of more harm to the small businessman right now than would a minor increase in spousal benefits. 5 years ago, Forbes did an amazing set of extrapolations as to what nationwide same-sex marriages would mean for the economy, based on the calculation that there would be 464,000 additional hitchings. Reception, catering, and wedding planning up $4.7 billion, $153 million of that just to the wedding planners. Wedding gift purchases, $3.94 billion. Honeymoons, $1.7 billion. Engagement rings, $1.66 billion. Wedding gowns and other apparel, $1.3 billion. Photography and video, an even billion. Flora and decor, another $816 million. Music and entertainment, $659 million. Wedding bands, $604 million. Invitations and stationery, $217 million. Cakes, $197 million. Total increase in our gross national wedding product, $16.8 billion. $16.8 billion! My God, Steele, it's a stimulus package. They'd be worth $16.8 billion a year to the economy, but same-sex marriage would hurt small business. What the?
We added the music to Keith Olbermann's comments on his MSNBC Countdown program.
This is Augustine Burroughs, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian news magazine.
This Way Out correspondent Janet Mason reflects on the legacy of a gay martyr born May 22, 1930.
The first time I saw a movie about Harvey Bernard Milk, it was 1984, and I had a ticket for the premiere showing at the Roxy Movie Theater on Sansom Street in Philadelphia. I was 25 and had come out a few years before. Inside the small but cozy theater, the audience was comprised mainly of gay men with a few pockets of lesbians here and there. The Times of Harvey Milk opened with Dianne Feinstein, the first female president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, announcing that San Francisco City Supervisor Harvey Milk and Mayor George Moscone had been assassinated. As the documentary progressed with the narration of Harvey Firestein, one of the few openly gay actors of the time, I became aware of an unusual sound coming from all around me. I realized then that it was the sound of men sitting in the dark, softly crying. In those days, my activist life was divided into two camps, women's liberation, which is where most of the lesbians were, and the gay movement, at that time still predominantly men. Often, I was the person who brought the two groups together. I invited Frank Broderick, the then editor of the Philadelphia Gay, and, newly added since I had begun writing for them, lesbian newspaper, the now defunct Au Courant, to come speak to a feminist collective I was working with. The members of my feminist newspaper collective, the paper was called Labyrinth, were offended by the name of Frank's TNA column in Au Courant. With a glint of humor in his eye, he insisted that the TNA graphic stood for tidbits and advice. Of course, there was a double entendre, and of course, most gay men would have found it funny. Today, most lesbians would find it funny also, but times were different then. We were still on the heels of a feminist revolution that made it possible for women to have equality and therefore to be independent from men. Hence the slogan, "A woman without a man is like a fish without a bicycle." I saw Milk over the holidays and watched it back to back with the original documentary. Milk, the movie, came across as a well-done, fictionalized version of the documentary with some original archival news footage and an opening scene of gay men being let out of a bar and put into a paddy wagon, the historic context of our gay lives. Sean Penn plays a convincing, although stereotypically gayer, Harvey Milk. One of the most poignant scenes in the movie is when Harvey receives a telephone call from a gay teen in a small town in the Midwest, saying he was going to kill himself until he saw Harvey on television. Before the conversation was cut off, Harvey manages to tell the young person to move to the nearest city. Harvey Milk was assassinated in 1978, my first year of college. I have a dim memory of the news accounts at the time, possibly because it was not a headline story in the mainstream media. I did not come out until I was 23. Call it denial or survival, I was not consciously aware of my sexual orientation until then. When I left the suburban working-class tract house development of Levittown, PA, where I had grown up, I wasn't yet out, but I instinctively moved to the nearest largest city. A few years after I had left, a young gay man named Anthony Milano, who lived in the same neighborhood where I grew up, was brutally murdered. This was one of the first reported hate crimes. I really didn't know much about Harvey Milk when he was living. I have never been to the Castro, where Harvey was the unofficial mayor of Castro Street, the 1970s mecca for gay men. But Harvey Milk is my hero, too. And so is Anthony Milano, who was so bravely himself in a redneck neighborhood that I had to flee before coming out. Today, gay men and lesbians are working together, and we are a force to be reckoned with. It's true, we've had our setbacks. It often feels like the proverbial one step forward and two steps back, but we are, in fact, still marching. This is Janet Mason on Queer Life and Literature for This Way Out.
Our audiophilers cruise the European continent this month for three great new CDs from the world of LGBT music.
Ein Gedanke verloren in einem so altbekannten Spiel. Ich fühlte mich doch hier wie neu geboren. Jetzt liege ich trotzdem wieder am Boden. Es kam so unerwartet, schau dir meine Karten an, ich musste spielen, hätte nie erwartet, dass ich so verliere, den Schuss so verziehe. Ich wollte spielen, spielen, spielen.
Welcome to a very international edition of Audiophile. Hi, I'm J.D. Doyle.
And I'm Chris Wilson. Switzerland's Bettina Schelker's newest album, The Honeymoon Is Over, features her unique folk-pop sound in both German and English.
The Honeymoon Is Over is my first record where I sing half of the songs in English. And that gave me the opportunity to go out there all over the world and sing my songs and tell stories and, yeah.
Out of the closet, no, again, back to bed. Yes, I am still my best friend again. Oh no, oh no, oh no, the honeymoon is over. Oh no, oh no, no. Oh no, oh no, oh no, the honeymoon is over. Oh no, oh no, no.
Again, the album by Bettina Schelker is called The Honeymoon Is Over. But Bettina and her wife are happily and legally married, something you can do in Switzerland. Her website name proudly reflects that. It's www.foundagirl.com.
From Scotland, Horse McDonald generally just goes by Horse. Her eighth full-length album is called Coming Up for Air.
It takes more than a key to unlock my heart. Oh, did you aim shot the gills at the stun my
album by Horace covers a wide range of personal experiences on love, loss, and learning.
The new album is called Coming Up for Air, and it probably tells you in the title where I am or where I was during the making of the album. I've come out of a dark patch where I lost both parents very quickly after each other and found the whole experience quite empowering and cathartic, in fact.
Love, is it me or is it you? Is there something I don't do? Should there be a me and you?
Find out more about the CD Coming Up for Air by Horse at www.randan.org. That's www.randan.org.
Out of southern England, Wire Daisies is the name of a band and also their latest album.
The album is the Wire Daisies' first North American release, and it combines tracks from their first two albums along with some new songs. Lead vocalist Trina Morris talks about the music itself.
The album is a collection of songs, some very soft and very acoustic, a little bit of piano and voice and heartfelt. And then there are some where everyone gets to do their thing, there's a lot more rockier tracks, and it kind of goes from one extreme to the other, really. But I think what keeps all together is the songs themselves. I think we're all very happy with it, and I hope everybody likes it.
More about Wire Daisies and their new self-titled CD at www.wiredaisies.com.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. You can write to us at 594 Sawdust Road, number 273, Spring, Texas 77380, or by visiting our website at www.audiophile.org. That's www.audiophile.org.
Audiophile is produced by J.D. Doyle, Chris Wilson, and Christopher David Trenton. I'm J.D. Doyle.
And I'm Chris Wilson. Keep listening.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Chris Coleman, Rick Watts, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Augustin Burroughs, John Frame, Janet Mason, and J.D. Doyle, Chris Wilson, and Christopher David Trentum contributed program material. Bettina Shelker, Horse, and Wire Daisies performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is underwritten in part by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can support our work, hear our podcasts, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on KEUL Hope and Girdwood, Alaska, 5GFM Kadena, South Australia, KUR Kutztown, Pennsylvania, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy. This way.
They tried to cover our eyes. Then they tried to tell us all what to see. We are discovering that did not work. For we were born to be free. It's a gay spirit singing in our hearts, leading us through these troubled times. It's a gay spirit moving round this land, calling us to a time of open love.
Welcome to Queer Music Heritage, and this is J.D. Doyle. I'm heard every month as a part of Queer Voices on KPFT, and frequent listeners of QMH may know that Gay Spirit by Charlie Murphy is one of the songs I've played most over the years. It's from the landmark album from 1979, Walls to Roses. I did an in-depth feature on that album last September, but this time I'm using its opening track to go in an entirely different direction. This is one of those rare shows where I'm not paying tribute to particular artists, but to someone very important who is behind the scenes. Did you ever wonder what a producer or engineer on an album really does, or what the difference is? Well, I'm one of those folks who pay attention to liner notes, such as the liner notes to the Walls to Roses album. And a name that kept coming up again and again in recordings in my collection is Karen Kane. She's both a producer and an engineer, and has had over 200 album credits and countless live shows in her career. She's been at it for more than 33 years, doing her work in Boston, Canada, and now in North Carolina. She's worked with a lot of artists dear to my heart, and we'll talk about many of them as well as the work itself. And later in the show, we've got some before and after clips to show you what magic a good producer and engineer can do. Interviewing her has been on my wish list for quite some time, so let's get to it. Karen, how did you get started doing recording engineering?
I was very fortunate when I was only 19 years old. I got a job through a family friend. The daughter of my parents had some friends, and their daughter was a studio manager at a studio in Manhattan called Six West Recording. And Six West Recording was a three-room, very busy jingle facility. And Beryl was looking for an assistant studio manager, reception, and I became her assistant, but within a year, she left, and the owners offered me her job. So there I was, 20 years old, the boss at a recording studio, and I learned the business end of it, and I ran the studio, the day-to-day business of the studio. And the equipment was always appealing to me, but there was this unspoken rule that women didn't touch the equipment. And so I didn't go near the equipment. I basically stayed in the business end of things for 3 years. But towards the end, I started to get enough of an interest where I didn't care about that unspoken rule anymore. And I'd come in on the weekends with some friends, some musician friends, and we'd start playing, and I'd start learning how to, you know, I knew enough to just get the mic through the board and hit record on the tape machine. And I'd make these recordings that were very amateur, but I started playing with the equipment. And towards the end of my time there, one of the engineers was sick one day, and there was a recording, like a single mono voiceover track for a commercial. And they said, oh, what are we going to do? We don't have any available engineers. And I raised my hand. I said, I'll do it. And they're like, you'll do it? And, you know, I didn't take myself too seriously at that point, but, and neither did they, but they thought, okay, I've taught myself enough to just sit in front of a console and record one mono voice. I could do that. So I did do that session, and that was the defining moment of me taking it more seriously. And that was the end of 1973. And I decided to move to Boston. It was a great time in Boston, exciting years for me. And I got a job as a studio manager at a studio called Intermedia Sound. And right away I started doing practice sessions on off hours. And by 1976, I met Lilith, I met Jaden Sarsfield. I can't remember how I met them. It goes a little too far back for me. But early in 76, somehow, because I was one of the only female engineers, I got a job doing live sound for Jaden Sarsfield. I mean, they're both very incredible musicians. And at one point, I asked them to be my guinea pigs at the studio so I could practice recording. So I have this very basement tape, Jaden Sarsfield tape, that nobody knows exists. It's quite something to hear that tape. The recording is pretty bad. I mean, I was definitely practicing and learning and all that. But they loved the piano. Janet Hood loved the piano at that studio. And they decided to do their album there. So I think it was like spring of 76. They decided to do the album at Intermedia Sound. And I was only experienced enough to be the assistant engineer. And after that album, I asked my boss at the studio to fire me as a studio manager and rehire me as an official apprentice engineer. And he said yes, which was pretty amazing. And that began my career. And I started doing projects for, I did a project for Joanna Kasdan in 1977. I did the Lilith album in 1978. 79, I believe it was 79, I did Maxine Feldman's album. That same year, I believe it was the same year, was the Walls to Roses project.
So you've just named some pillars of our history there.
Yes.
That you were right in the midst of.
Yes.
We were talking about Jade and Sarsfield. That was the name Linda Langford and Janet Hood used for performing, and the name of their first album from 1976, one of the earlier ones to contain Gasp, actual lesbian lyrics. Here's a little of their song, She's That Kind of Woman.
See you. She's a kind of woman.
and then on to Lilith. Again, you know, this is like the core of the Boston music scene.
Mm-hmm.
I've interviewed Beth Courant.
Yes. Yes. And actually, I saw on your site the... Of course, I listened to every bit of it, and then I contacted Beth, and we've had a little bit of reunion, which has been really nice. The Lilith album was wonderful for me in that I was doing a full band project.
From that Lilith album from 1978 is the title track, Boston Ride.
Boston Ride.
Basically, Beth and I, you know, the band dynamics were very hard, and Beth and I basically mixed that album and made it happen. So we got very close in that process, and I listened to it as like, not too bad for 1978. You know, it helped them for a while with their career, but they were having such terrible band dynamic problems that they didn't last. Unfortunately.
Well, a project that did last was Walls to Roses.
I'll say that project was the next 12 years of my life. Walls to Roses opened up a whole new community for me, both personally and professionally, because I connected to all of these people on such a deep level that the local ones, anyway, all became my family, my crowd, my, you know, and by 1980, I was in a relationship with Marcia Taylor and doing everybody's albums. Willie Sordillo used to joke and call me the sound wizard of the left in Boston. Because I did everybody's albums. I did Bright Morning Star albums and Charlie King albums and Fred Small and Willie's albums. And, you know, it just went on and on and on. Basically, I have to give the Walls to Roses collective the credit for me getting better at my work. Because the interesting thing about this is that they hired me because they wanted to use a woman in a traditionally male job. And so in the very beginning, I got jobs because I was a woman. Whether I was good or not didn't even matter.
Those lefties.
Yeah, really, exactly. So they hired me because, hey, a woman sound engineer. So I got those jobs, and because of it, and it just kept happening, and I got better and better and better. And I did, you know, God knows how many years, 12 years of all these acoustic albums. But I really have to thank that whole community for my beginning and all those albums that I did that helped me really become quite good at what I did.
I've always put that album on a pedestal as a landmark album.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, this past year, as you know, got to devote an entire show to it.
Yes, I know. I listened to every word of it. It was wonderful. Yeah, it was great.
Thank you. I want to get to Maxine Feldman.
Mm-hmm. Maxine and I hit it off the instant we met. And what was interesting about Maxine is that, well, the story that's interesting is that there was this small label, these two women who started this label, I believe, called Galaxia.
Right.
Yeah. And we really didn't get along with them that well. Meaning that there was a communication gap, or actually, Anna Marie Taylor, I believe, was her name, and I think there was a language barrier. I think she was an Italian woman who, I didn't know how long was in the country, but she, we just didn't connect that well. But Maxine was delighted that they wanted to do an album. And the other thing that was hard is that the women from the label chose a producer for Maxine. And she either did the album with this person or didn't do it at all. So Maxine and I had this joke. And the joke is, and I have an album signed where it says, "To Karen, the best producer a girl could have." And the joke is that her and I produced the album and basically ignored the person who was credited as producer, because I did not get credit as producer. So that was a little hard, but we were delighted to be able to do that project.
Do you have a favorite track from that album that you remember?
A favorite track? Well, Amazon is one of my favorites, and I am very proud when I am at the Michigan Women's Music Festival. There's a opening ceremony of the festival, and the ritual is that Amazon is sung every single year. So for every year for the 23 years I've been going to Michigan, I get to hear Amazon, and I feel very pleased and proud that I was a part of that.
That's got to be quite a moving experience to listen to that there.
Oh, my God. Judith Castleberry usually is the person who does the music for the opening ceremony, and they put together a full band, and it's usually in a reggae format, and it's just wonderful. And it's very moving. I have tears in my eyes when that happens, for sure, especially now that Maxine has passed.
Right. I only spoke to her once. I interviewed her, and we just hit it off immediately.
She's that kind of person. She really was.
Amazon women rise. Amazon women weaving rainbows in the sky. Amazon women fly. Amazon women fly. I am and once was called Amazon. Now I am called lesbian. I know that the matriarchy ruled back then. Sisters, the matriarchy's gonna rule again. Amazon women rise. Amazon women weaving rainbows in the sky. Amazon women fly. Amazon women fly.
Of course, that was the classic lesbian anthem, Amazon, by Maxine Feldman. It came from her only album, Closet Sale, from 1979. It pains me that we don't have time for the entire song, but there's just so much of Karen Kane's career to cover that we're not going to be able to play full songs.
Maxine introduced me to Kay Gardner. Kay Gardner, I don't remember exactly what year it was, but it was 1980, 81. Kay, once she knew about me, she gave me a small job of transferring some reel-to-reel tapes to cassette. And she would sit and tell me of her plan to write and record a Rainbow Path. And then, of course, we got together and worked on that in 1983, and it was released in 84. That was the beginning of a very, very wonderful relationship, both personally and professionally. But Kay and I were very close. That was incredibly hard.
Kay Gardner passed away in 2002 and was at the forefront of composers creating lyrical music for healing, relaxation, and meditation. Karen and Kay worked on about a dozen albums together over the years, and from that first one, in 1984, called Rainbow Path, is a little of a track called Awakening.
Take a step back and tell me the difference between the work of a producer and an engineer.
Mm-hmm. Well, the short answer is that an engineer is responsible for everything technical, and the producer is responsible for everything musical. So there are people who do both, like I do, and so I'm responsible for all of it, musical and technical. And the engineer's job is to record everything as cleanly and accurately as possible. And the producer, you know, if you're going to have a hierarchy, the producer is the boss and tells the engineer what to do. And a producer does things like, okay, your guitar is out of tune, or you're singing flat, or yeah, the track speeds up here, and also works on arrangement changes with songs, which is done before you go in the studio. So the producer sits with the artist and the musicians going into the studio and does pre-production. Pre-production prepares you for the studio, and you work on the arrangements of the song, and you work on rehearsing with the people who are going to perform. Then you go in the studio, and then you join up with the engineer, if there's a separate engineer. And that person is responsible for all the microphones and getting it all recorded as beautifully as possible.
I would think if it's two different people, it could vary from project to project as to who really contributed the most.
Yes. That's true. That's very true. There are, actually, I've heard stories of some very well-known producers who just sat there reading magazines. They got hired because of their fame, and they just sat there reading magazines while the engineer did all the work. So, yes.
Or the engineer knew more.
Or the engineer knew more, for sure. But I've been doing both for quite a while now. I think starting around 1985 or so, I started to feel more confident to do both producing and engineering.
I was going to joke with you that you started in 76, kind of, so this would be your 33 and a third anniversary.
That's true. Whew, it's been a long time.
A couple years ago, I interviewed Trett Fury, who got her start as an engineer on the West Coast, and she talked about this, so I can't leave out this question. In the 70s, for a woman to have a recording career was just out of the question.
I have a few stories that show how hard it was. Now, at one point, Intermediate Sound, where we did the Jaden Sarsaparilla and I did Joanna Kasdan's album, by the end of 1977, the studio got sold and I got laid off. And I went to every studio in the state of Massachusetts for a job as an engineer. And I got one offer, and that offer was to be a studio manager, not an engineer. Nobody would hire me as an engineer. So I said, screw everybody. And I took a little ad out in what was called then Musicians Magazine in Boston, just a little local publication, and I took an ad out saying, freelance engineer available. And I have been freelance since that day. And I struggled with not having enough work at times, but it built up and up with the help, of course, of my new community, all the folkies. The advertising was very helpful. And I had this very well-known saying in my ad, unbiased advice about recording and recording studios. Because I didn't work for any particular studio. I went from studio to studio to studio to studio, depending on the needs of the project. And it worked. People called me, and I started to get gigs. Here's a story. In the early 80s, I worked at a studio called Euphoria Sound, where Rainbow Path was recorded. And I'm sitting at the board doing a session. And I'm obviously doing engineer's work. And there was another session scheduled in for the evening. And some guy opens the door to the control room, comes in, looking all around, looks me straight in the eye, sitting at the board doing work, and says, where's the engineer? So, I mean, the awareness, you know, was not there.
I was going to ask if you also experienced, not only because of being a woman, did you experience resistance in getting jobs for being a lesbian?
I would say no. It was more the female thing.
And I bet many of my listeners would be surprised to know that Karen engineered the first demo done by Tracy Chapman.
Aha. So I believe it was 1986. And a photographer friend named Susan Wilson, very well known in Boston, called me up and said, I want to make a demo. There's this young woman that I want to record. And I said, fine, okay. And we go to the studio, and Tracy walks in and gets to the microphone, and I am floored, of course. She did four songs. Revolution was one of them. For My Baby, I think, was another one. Can't quite remember all of them. And I remember thinking, this would be a good time to start a record label, and she would be the first person I would sign. I knew it instantly that she had star quality. Instantly. Now, I don't know how much influence Susan Wilson had on the rest of her career, but Tracy was living with a college roommate, and her roommate's father is very big in the industry in L.A., and that's how that happened. I think the roommate heard the demo, and you know, the demo, all the local Boston stations started playing it, and I kicked myself for not having a copy of it, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I did ask the question.
Yes, you did. And I think the rest is history.
One of my icons is Alex Dobkin.
Oh, yes. I had an incredible experience by being flown to Australia to record Yahoo Australia. And I have a funny story about that. So I get flown to Sydney, and I meet up with Alex and her entourage. This was 1990. I had found somehow the name of a recording truck, and I faxed them and asked them if they could record at this certain venue, and they said yes, and okay, we set it all up. So then I get to Sydney, and we did an afternoon show, I believe, and an evening show. And during the evening show, I'm in the truck with the guy who owns the truck, or the assistant, I'm not sure who it was, and he goes, "What's this over here?" And he hits a button, takes the recording machine out of record. So we're missing some bars of her concert. And so, you know, we put it back in record, and then I had to do an edit. I had to take those many measures from the afternoon show and insert them into the evening show, because the afternoon show was really just a backup, because we'd have a larger crowd in the evening show. We wanted the evening show would be the main album. And so I edited the afternoon show to the evening show, and the remarkable thing is, if the tempo isn't the same, it would sound terrible. But Alex is so steady that it worked.
And the background ambiance was compatible, I guess.
It was compatible enough in just a few measures.
How many seconds are we talking, roughly?
We're talking anywhere between 5 and 10 seconds.
Okay.
Yeah. So I don't think anyone would notice. I can't even remember what song it's on. If I heard the album, I would not have a clue.
Yeah, you did such a good job, you couldn't find it.
Exactly.
Here's part of the title track from the album Yahoo Australia by Alex Dobkin.
South is cool, north is warm, May and autumn is the norm. No Big Dipper or Evening Star. The Southern Cross tells me I'm far from home. Dingoes and koala bears, land of kangaroos, emus, wallabies, and kookaburras in the old countries. And I'm falling for Australia. I'm singing gooey-dooey, women of Australia. Say g'day, love your lingo, full on doinks, good on ya girls, mind those hooning daggy yamas. Oh, what do you reckon? How you going driving on the left hand side? Love your big wide strappy style, rave on conversations. I couldn't get a word in the Yahoo Australia. Australia, dingoes and koala bears, land of kangaroos, emus, wallabies, and kookaburras in the old gum trees. And I
Again, that was Alex Dobkin. And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as visual as well as an audio experience. And this is another one of those shows where I had much too much great material for just 1 hour. So you can find part two on my site. I had to make some very painful decisions on who had to move to the second hour. And that included hearing about Karen's work with some terrific artists like Suede, Fred Small, Wishing Chair, Ember Swift, Alex Olson, and others. See what I mean? So you can find a second hour of this show on my site. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Saturday night, Sunday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude. Karen, how does live sound engineering differ from the studio?
Oh, it differs a lot. The skills are a little different. Although I do quite a lot of live sound and enjoy it a lot of live sound engineers have never been in a studio. So they don't know about, you know, the recording programs today, or back then they didn't know, for instance, how to calibrate a tape machine. They didn't know the difference between, you know, this studio mic and this studio mic. And there's a lot of things about the studio that you don't get to learn when you're at a concert. And there are lots of live sound engineers who do studio work, but I was doing both early on, so that's why I was able to do both. But some can't. A live sound engineer who's never been in a studio couldn't just come into a studio and start working it. However, a studio engineer could very easily, once all the equipment's all set up, go to a live sound gig and start mixing.
No retakes live, though.
No retakes live, that's for sure. And dealing with feedback is something, very annoying thing, you know. It's a skill to learn how to do that. You don't have to deal with that in the studio. So that's something that would be hard for a studio engineer who doesn't have that much live experience.
A very prominent live recording was NWMF, National Women's Music Festival, their silver anniversary.
That was a fantastic project. I recorded and mixed that. And I got to hire, because the budget was decent, I got to hire a wonderful recording truck out of Chicago. Wonderful guys. They were so good. They let me take over and I did the whole thing, and they just helped me in whatever way they could. It was a wonderful experience, and then I got to mix all of it. It was quite a long project. It was great. As opposed to the Dyketones, the guys we hired for the Dyketones recording, you know, that was in P-Town. And we hired a well-known live recording engineer and a truck. And I thought to myself, oh, I'll learn a lot from them. Well, as it turns out, they came to P-Town and thought they were on vacation. They'd be hanging out in the bars and the restaurant when they're supposed to be sound checking with me. You know, they really took advantage of the situation, and it was, and I had to take over, which I did, because they'd rather be on vacation.
I don't remember seeing that on your album list.
You know what? Here's an interesting thing about that, and I'm gonna fix this. I think initially when I put my website together, which was a long time ago, 10 years or more, yeah, like 12 years, I was slightly homophobic about the name myself. I didn't want to come out on my website because I don't know why. But I'm going to rectify that, actually. I'm going to put it in there. Thank you for bringing that up.
And she did add the Dyketones to her website's discography. The fabulous Dyketones released one album called Live in P-Town in 1988. When I did a feature interview on them on my February 2005 show, I played quite a few songs by them. but didn't have room for this oldie but goodie, 16 candles.
Happy birthday.
Okay, before we got distracted by the Dyke Tones, and that's an easy thing to do, we had been talking about the live project Karen engineered. It was called NWMF Sober and was the 25th anniversary celebration of the National Women's Music Festival. And that year must have been terrific, with Chris Williamson, Trett Fury, Farron, Teresa Trall, and Zrazy, among others. And one of those others was Janis Ian.
That was a real highlight for me, doing that album. Working with Janis Ian was a dream for me, because she's, I think, by far my favorite songwriter of all time.
Wow.
When she came out with that album, Breaking Silence, I was blown away by that album, and I used it for a lot of things. That album became, not only for my personal pleasure, but I used it as a reference for myself to get inspired in the studio. And I would use it to compare what mixes I was doing to her mixes, because I loved that album in many ways, musically, recording-wise, mixing-wise. And so it became a very important album to me.
How was the interaction at the actual event?
Well, that, talk about a highlight, was really special for me, because I was honored and delighted to have a chance to work with Janis Ian. You know, it wasn't Janis Ian who hired me for the album. It was the producers of the festival, and she happened to be in the lineup. But we connected really well, because we had a chance to have some personal hangout time, and we found out we had a lot in common. We were born in the same year. We both are Jewish. We both grew up in New York. And so we had a lot in common. So we hit it off. Professionally, we also had some personal contact, because she had to approve the mixes before the producers could use the recording and then get the CDs pressed. So I had some professional interaction with her, as well as personal. It just was a thrill for me.
From NWMF Silver, here's a little of Hunger by Janis Ian.
I
the sky for the weight of the sun. I hunger for you like the tide for the moon to come. I hunger for you like the skin of a doe for the blade. I hunger for you like the sins of the lost for the saved. A hunger in the body, a hunger in the soul, a hunger when I'm lonely, a hunger when I'm whole, hunger in the heart, hunger in the home, never we're apart, I'm hungry to the bone.
That's beautiful. Just part of the almost 8-minute performance of that song by Janice Ian at the National Women's Music Festival. Early in the show, I mentioned that you would get to hear the before and after difference in the work Karen does. She sent me a very raw track called Free from the latest album by the duo Someone's Sister. Let's talk about Someone's Sister.
Yay! Someone's Sister have become very good friends of mine. They live very close to me. And their second album has just been out not that long, the new album. And Georgia Winfrey and Catherine Jones are incredible together. And they would give me, they'd give me demos that I would listen to, and I would choose the song. And I'd say, I like this one, I like this one, I like this one, and so on.
Hmm.
And, of course, they had a say in it, but they wanted to know what I thought. So then we would all agree on the song. And then we would go into pre-production. And the demo I sent you has a rehearsal of one of the songs called Free. That's the first cut of their new album.
Well, this is cool. Karen sent me a demo and also sent me the finished track so my listeners can hear the difference. Can you talk about what you did to get it to the finished product?
Well, first of all, the difference between a rehearsal demo is that the recording is a, you know, low-quality home recording, so that the studio quality difference is going to be outstanding. And the musicianship of all the hired musicians is incredible on the album. And the song Free, there's some different vocals in there that are not on the demo, and vocals are obviously their strong suit.
I think they're added layers of percussion and so forth.
Yeah, and a lot of layers of guitar work. Yeah, it's a great song.
Okay, here's the very before version of the song Free, and then the finished product.
You left me with wounds no one can see. Now I try to heal them, but it's killing me. To rescue the child.
Here's where we switch over to the album version.
Feels like I am free. I'm awake in the morning song.
Want to hear more? That's from the brand new album by Someone's Sister, Calm in the Chaos. And you can hear another example of Before and After Work by Karen on a song by another artist if you tune in to part two of this interview on my website. I hear a lot of albums, especially by bands, where I think, gee, I wish I could understand the words better.
Well, that happens a lot. I think one of my specialties is dealing with vocals and coaching singers for them to not only sing in tune, but just the expression. And when I mix, I make sure every word is heard. If I have to sit there and program in to bring up, you know, the end of a word, I do that for every vocal. You want to know what they're singing about.
I don't want to leave out your nominations for Juno Awards, which are Canadian Grammys.
Oh, yes, the Canadian Grammy. I was just so elated to have, I believe I have three of them now. Jack Grunsky. Jack is a children's artist. So it was for the Best Children's Recording. That was my first Juno nomination. He did not win. None of them won, but, you know, it's an honor to be nominated. Then Big Daddy G, unfortunately, so sad. February 24th, Dave Glover got killed in a car accident. The Big Daddy G guy. So we're all kind of mourning that. But his blues album, Best Blues Album of the Year, got a nomination. And then Harry Manx, more acoustic blues, you know, acoustic guitar, bluesy, great voice.
I'm down to the last song. This went way too fast, and I want to thank you all for listening and Karen Kane for the delightful interview. You can find out more about her work at her website, www.mixmama.com. And you can find much more about this interview on my site at www.queermusicheritage.com. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. I'm closing the show with an artist out of Toronto who released a CD EP in 2008 that Karen produced and engineered. The CD's title is I Am Who I Am, and of course the title track has an anthem quality to it, just perfect for this show. I would like to hear about your working with Anna Gutmanis.
Anna called me. Actually, she emailed me and said, I have this project I want to do. Can you refer me to any female producers in Toronto? And I wrote her back and said, no, not really. I didn't really know anyone who was female who was doing what I do there, believe it or not, in a huge city like Toronto. I really couldn't come up with anyone that would fit in, because she actually really wanted to work with a lesbian. So I wrote her back and I said, you want me? And she wrote back and said, okay, what do I have to do? And I said, you just come to Wilmington. And so she came to Wilmington. I hired some musicians. We recorded at the bigger studio here and mixed it at home. And away she went. And, you know, this great songs that she did. She's a great musician.
In particular, can you talk about her song, I Am Who I Am?
Well, that's a song that's angry and needs to be out there. It's a great song.
I'm thinking of ending the show with that song, because I want something that is really more up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty up.
Yeah,
you know?
Really?
Yeah, I mean, it has that angry, I am who I am, damn it.
Yeah.
Yeah, the lyrics are terrific, and it's a great song.
I'm out, I'm proud, I've done the things I've thought. Nobody gonna
Listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Walensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Walensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
First you listen, then you fall in love. You have your favorite programs that you listen to each and every week. And finally, you do the right thing by calling in that pledge of support to KPFT. You feel great, but guess what? Your job, it's not done just yet. You still need to fulfill your promise to KPFT by sending that pledge payment today. And when you do, you take that often forgotten last step. Don't wait any longer. KPFT depends on you.
When you tune in to KPFT, you notice something right away. No ads.
KPFT is a non-commercial radio station. We don't accept advertising or underwriting from businesses, nor does KPFT receive payment for any program we air.
KPFT further disallows product plug-in or endorsements.
We do this because you, the listener, deserve access to the radio you love without all the commercials, taglines, and cross-promotion.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.